one which political leaders would use to mobilize the population against England, granting some benefits for the rebellious poor, and many more for themselves in the process. The tenant riots in New Jersey in the 1740s, the New York tenant uprisings of the 1750s and 1760s in the Hudson Valley, and the rebellion in northeastern New York that led to the carving of Vermont out of New York State were all more than sporadic rioting. They were long-lasting social movements, highly organized, involving the creation of counter-governments. They were aimed at a handful of rich landlords, but with the landlords far away, they often had to direct their anger against farmers who had leased the disputed land from the owners. See Edward Countryman's pioneering work on rural rebellion. Just as the Jersey rebels had broken into jails to free their friends, rioters in the Hudson Valley rescued prisoners from the sheriff, and one time took the sheriff himself as prisoner. The tenants were seen as chiefly the dregs of the people, and the posse that the sheriff of Albany County led to Bennington in 1771 included the privileged top of the local power structure. The land rioters saw their battle as poor against rich. A witness at a rebel leader's trial in New York in 1766 said that the farmers evicted by the landlords had an equitable title but could not be defended in a course of law because they were poor, and poor men were always oppressed by the rich. Ethan Allen's Green Mountain Rebels in Vermont described themselves as a poor people, fatigued in settling a wilderness country, and their opponents as a number of attorneys and other gentlemen with all their tackle of ornaments and compliments and French finesse. Land-hungry farmers in the Hudson Valley turned to the British for support against the American landlords. The Green Mountain Rebels did the same. But as the conflict with Britain intensified, the colonial leaders of the movement for independence, aware of the tendency of poor tenants to side with the British in their anger against the rich, adopted policies to win over people in the countryside. In North Carolina, a powerful movement of white farmers was organized against wealthy and corrupt officials in the period from 1766 to 1771, exactly those years when in the cities of the Northeast, agitation was growing against the British, crowding out class issues. Movement in North Carolina was called the Regulator Movement, and it consisted, says Marvin L. Mitchell Kay, a specialist in the history of that movement, of class-conscious white farmers in the West who attempted to democratize local government in their respective counties. The regulators referred to themselves as poor industrious peasants, as laborers, the wretched poor, oppressed by rich and powerful designing monsters. The regulators saw that a combination of wealth and political power ruled North Carolina and denounced those officials whose highest study is the promotion of their wealth. They resented the tax system, which was especially burdensome on the poor, and the combination of merchants and lawyers who worked in the courts to collect debts from the harassed farmers. In the western counties where the movement developed, only a small percentage of the households had slaves, and 41% of these were concentrated to take one sample western county in less than 2% of the households. The regulators did not represent servants or slaves, but they did speak for small owners, squatters, and tenants. A contemporary account of the regulator movement in Orange County describes the situation. Thus were the people of Orange insulted by the sheriff, robbed and plundered, neglected and condemned by the representatives, and abused by the magistracy, obliged to pay fees regulated only by the avarice of the officer, obliged to pay a tax which they believed went to enrich and aggrandize a few who lorded it over them continually, and from all these evils they saw no way to escape, for the men in power and legislation were the men whose interest it was to oppress and make gain of the laborer. In that county in the 1760s, the regulators organized to prevent the collection of taxes or the confiscation of the property of tax delinquents. Officials said, An absolute insurrection of a dangerous tendency has broke out in Orange County, and made military plans to suppress it. At one point, 700 armed farmers forced the release of 2 arrested regulator leaders. The regulators petitioned the government on their grievances in 1768, citing, "The unequal chances the poor and the weak have in contentions with the rich and powerful." In another county, Anson, a local militia colonel complained of the unparalleled tumults, insurrections, and commotions which at present distract this county. At one point, 100 men broke up the proceedings at a county court, but they also tried to elect farmers to the assembly, asserting that a majority of our assembly is composed of lawyers, clerks, and others in connection with them. In 1770, there was a large-scale riot in Hillsboro, North Carolina, in which they disrupted a court, forced the judge to flee, beat 3 lawyers and 2 merchants, and looted stores. The result of all this was that the assembly passed some mild reform legislation, but also an act to prevent riots and tumults, and the governor prepared to crush them militarily. In May of 1771, there was a decisive battle in which several thousand regulators were defeated by a disciplined army using cannon. 6 regulators were hanged. Kay says that in the 3 western counties of Orange, Anson, and Rowan, where the regulator movement was concentrated, it had the support of 6,000 to 7,000 men out of a total white taxable population of about 8,000. One consequence of this bitter conflict is that only a minority of the people in the regulator counties seem to have participated as patriots in the Revolutionary War. Most of them probably remained neutral. Fortunately for the revolutionary movement, the key battles were being fought in the North, and here, in the cities, the colonial leaders had a divided white population. They could win over the mechanics, who were a kind of middle class, who had a stake in the fight against England, who faced competition from English manufacturers. The biggest problem was to keep the propertyless people, who were unemployed and hungry in the crisis following the French War, under control. In Boston, the economic grievances of the lowest classes mingled with anger against the British and exploded in mob violence. The leaders of the independence movement wanted to use that mob energy against England, but also to contain it so that it would not demand too much from them. When riots against the Stamp Act swept Boston in 1767, they were analyzed by the commander of the British forces in North America, General Thomas Gage, as follows. "The Boston mob, raised first by the instigation of many of the principal inhabitants, allured by plunder, rose shortly after of their own accord, attacked, robbed, and destroyed several houses, and amongst others that of the lieutenant governor. People then began to be terrified at the spirit they had raised, to perceive that popular fury was not to be guided, and each individual feared he might be the next victim of their rapacity. The same fears spread through the other provinces, and there has been as much pains taken since to prevent insurrections of the people as before to excite them." Gage's comment suggests leaders of the movement against the Stamp Act had instigated crowd action, but then became frightened by the thought that it might be directed against their wealth, too. At this time, the top 10% of Boston's taxpayers held about 66% of Boston's taxable wealth, while the lowest 30% of the taxpaying population had no taxable property at all. The propertyless could not vote, and so, like blacks, women, Indians, could not participate in town meetings. This included sailors, journeymen, apprentices, servants. Dick Horder, a student of Boston mob actions in the Revolutionary period, calls the revolutionary leadership the Sons of Liberty type drawn from the middling interest and well-to-do merchants, a hesitant leadership, wanting to spur action against Great Britain, yet worrying about maintaining control over the crowds at home. It took the Stamp Act crisis to make this leadership aware of its dilemma. A political group in Boston called the Loyal Nine merchants, distillers, shipowners, and master craftsmen who opposed the Stamp Act, organized a procession in August 1765 to protest it. They put 50 master craftsmen at the head, but needed to mobilize shipworkers from the North End and mechanics and apprentices from the South End. 2,000 or 3,000 were in the procession. Negroes were excluded. They marched to the home of the stamp master and burned his effigy. But after the gentleman who organized the demonstration left, the crowd went further and destroyed some of the stamp master's property. These were, as one of the Loyal Nine said, amazingly inflamed people. The Loyal Nine seemed taken aback by the direct assault on the wealthy furnishings of the stamp master. The rich set up armed patrols. Now a town meeting was called, and the same leaders who had planned the demonstration denounced the violence and disavowed the actions of the crowd. As more demonstrations were planned for November 1, 1765, when the Stamp Act was to go into effect, and for Pope's Day, November 5th, steps were taken to keep things under control. A dinner was given for certain leaders of the rioters to win them over. And when the Stamp Act was repealed due to overwhelming resistance, the conservative leaders severed their connections with the rioters. They held annual celebrations of the first anti-Stamp Act demonstration, to which they invited, according to Herder, not the rioters, but mainly upper and middle-class Bostonians who traveled in coaches and carriages to Roxbury or Dorchester for opulent feasts. When the British Parliament turned to its next attempt to tax the colonies, this time by a set of taxes which it hoped would not excite as much opposition, the colonial leaders organized boycotts. But they stressed, "No mobs or tumults, let the persons and properties of your most inveterate enemies be safe." Samuel Adams advised, "No mobs, no confusions, no tumult." And James Otis said that, "No possible circumstances, though ever so oppressive, could be supposed sufficient to justify private tumults and disorders." Impressment and the quartering of troops by the British were directly hurtful to the sailors and other working people. After 1768, 2,000 soldiers were quartered in Boston, and friction grew between the crowds and the soldiers. The soldiers began to take the jobs of working people when jobs were scarce. Mechanics and shopkeepers lost work or business because of the colonist boycott of British goods. In 1769, Boston set up a committee to consider of some suitable methods of employing the poor of the town, whose numbers and distresses are daily increasing by the loss of its trade and commerce. On March 5, 1770, grievances of ropemakers against British soldiers taking their jobs led to a fight. A crowd gathered in front of the custom house and began provoking the soldiers, who fired and killed first Crispus Attucks, a mulatto worker, then others. This became known as the Boston Massacre. Feelings against the British mounted quickly. There was anger at the acquittal of 6 of the British soldiers. 2 were punished by having their thumbs branded and were discharged from the army. The crowd at the massacre was described by John Adams, defense attorney for the British soldiers, as "a motley rabble of saucy boys, Negroes and mulattoes, Irish teagues and outlandish jack-tars." Perhaps 10,000 people marched in the funeral procession for the victims of the massacre, out of a total Boston population of 16,000. This led England to remove the troops from Boston and try to quiet the situation. Impressment was the background of the massacre. There had been impressment riots through the 1760s in New York and in Newport, Rhode Island, where 500 seamen, boys, and Negroes rioted after 5 weeks of impressment by the British. 6 weeks before the Boston Massacre, there was a battle in New York of seamen against British soldiers taking their jobs, and one seaman was killed. In the Boston Tea Party of December 1773, the Boston Committee of Correspondence, formed a year before to organize anti-British actions, controlled crowd action against the tea from the start, Dirk Horder says. The Tea Party led to the coercive acts by Parliament. virtually establishing martial law in Massachusetts, dissolving the colonial government, closing the port in Boston, and sending in troops. Still, town meetings and mass meetings rose in opposition. The seizure of a powder store by the British led 4,000 men from all around Boston to assemble in Cambridge, where some of the wealthy officials had their sumptuous homes. The crowd forced the officials to resign. The committees of correspondence of Boston and other towns welcomed this gathering, but warned against destroying private property. Pauline Meyer, who studied the development of opposition to Britain in the decade before 1776 in her book From Resistance to Revolution, emphasizes the moderation of the leadership, and despite their desire for resistance, their emphasis on order and restraint. She notes, "The officers and committee members of the Sons of Liberty were drawn almost entirely from the middle and upper classes of colonial society. In Newport, Rhode Island, for instance, the Sons of Liberty, according to a contemporary writer, contained some gentlemen of the first figure in town for opulent sense and politeness. In North Carolina, one of the wealthiest of the gentlemen and freeholders led the Sons of Liberty. Similarly, in Virginia and South Carolina. And New York's leaders, too, were involved in small but respectable independent business ventures. Their aim, however, was to broaden their organization, to develop a mass base of wage earners." Many of the Sons of Liberty groups declared, as in Milford, Connecticut, their greatest abhorrence of lawlessness, or as in Annapolis, supposed all riots or unlawful assemblies tending to the disturbance of the public tranquility. John Adams expressed the same fears. "These tarrings and featherings, this breaking open houses by rude and insolent rabbles in resentment for private wrongs or in pursuing of private prejudices and passions must be discountenanced." In Virginia, it seemed clear to the educated gentry that something needed to be done to persuade the lower orders to join the revolutionary cause, to deflect their anger against England. One Virginian wrote in his diary in the spring of 1774, "The lower class of people here are in tumult on account of reports from Boston. Many of them expect to be pressed and compelled to go and fight the Britons." Around the time of the Stamp Act, a Virginia orator addressed the poor. "Are not the gentlemen made of the same materials as the lowest and poorest among you? Listen to no doctrines which may tend to divide us, but let us go hand in hand as brothers." It was a problem for which the rhetorical talents of Patrick Henry were superbly fitted. He was, as Rhys Isaac put it, firmly attached to the world of the gentry, but he spoke in words that the poorer whites of Virginia could understand. Henry's fellow Virginian, Edmund Randolph, recalled his style as simplicity and even carelessness, his pauses, which for their length might sometimes be feared to dispel the attention, riveted it the more by raising the expectation. Patrick Henry's oratory in Virginia pointed a way to relieve class tension between upper and lower classes and form a bond against the British. This was to find language inspiring to all classes, specific enough in its listing of grievances to charge people with anger against the British, vague enough to avoid class conflict among the rebels, and stirring enough to build patriotic feeling for the resistance movement. Tom Paine's Common Sense, which appeared in early 1776 and became the most popular pamphlet in the American colonies, did this. It made the first bold argument for independence in words that any fairly literate person could understand. "Society in every state is a blessing, but government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil." Paine disposed of the idea of the divine right of kings by a pungent history of the British monarchy going back to the Norman conquest of 1066, when William the Conqueror came over from France to set himself on the British throne. a French bastard landing with an armed banditti and establishing himself King of England against the consent of the natives, is in plain terms a very paltry, rascally original. It certainly hath no divinity in it. Paine dealt with the practical advantages of sticking to England or being separated. He knew the importance of economics. I challenge the warmest advocate for reconciliation to show a single advantage that this continent can reap by being connected with Great Britain. I repeat the challenge. Not a single advantage is derived. Our corn will fetch its price in any market in Europe, and our imported goods must be paid for by them where we will. As for the bad effects of the connection with England, Paine appealed to the colonists' memory of all the wars in which England had involved them, wars costly in lives and money. But the injuries and disadvantages which we sustain by that connection are without number. Any submission to or dependence on Great Britain tends directly to involve this continent in European wars and quarrels and set us at variance with nations who would otherwise seek our friendship. He built slowly to an emotional pitch. Everything that is right or reasonable pleads for separation. The blood of the slain, the weeping voice of nature cries, 'Tis time to part. Common Sense went through 25 editions in 1776 and sold hundreds of thousands of copies. It is probable that almost every literate colonist either read it or knew about its contents. Pamphleteering had become by this time the chief theater of debate about relations with England. From 1750 to 1776, 400 pamphlets had appeared arguing one or another side of the Stamp Act or the Boston Massacre or the Tea Party or the general questions of disobedience to law, loyalty to government, rights and obligations. Paine's pamphlet appealed to a wide range of colonial opinion angered by England, but it caused some tremors in aristocrats like John Adams, who were with the patriot cause but wanted to make sure it didn't go too far in the direction of democracy. Paine had denounced the so-called balanced government of lords and commons as a deception and called for single-chamber representative bodies where the people could be represented. Adams denounced Paine's plan as so democratical without any restraint or even an attempt at any equilibrium or counterpoise that it must produce confusion and every evil work. Popular assemblies needed to be checked, Adams thought, because they were productive of hasty results and absurd judgments. Paine himself came out of the lower orders of England, a staymaker, tax official, teacher, poor emigrant to America. He arrived in Philadelphia in 1774, when agitation against England was already strong in the colonies. The artisan mechanics of Philadelphia, along with journeymen, apprentices, and ordinary laborers, were forming into a politically conscious militia, in general damned riffraff, dirty, mutinous, and disaffected, as local aristocrats described them. By speaking plainly and strongly, he could represent those politically conscious lower-class people. He opposed property qualifications for voting in Pennsylvania. But his great concern seems to have been to speak for a middle group. There is an extent of riches, as well as an extreme of poverty, which by harrowing the circles of a man's acquaintance lessens his opportunities of general knowledge. Once the revolution was underway, Paine more and more made it clear that he was not for the crowd action of lower-class people, like those militia who in 1779 attacked the house of James Wilson. Wilson was a revolutionary leader who opposed price controls and wanted a more conservative government than was given by the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. Paine became an associate of one of the wealthiest men in Pennsylvania, Robert Morris, and a supporter of Morris's creation, the Bank of North America. Later, during the controversy over adopting the Constitution, Paine would once again represent urban artisans who favored a strong central government. He seemed to believe that such a government could represent some great common interest. In this sense, he lent himself perfectly to the myth of the revolution, that it was on behalf of a united people. The Declaration of Independence brought that myth to its peak of eloquence. Each harsher measure of British control, the proclamation of 1763 not allowing colonists to settle beyond the Appalachians, the Stamp Act, the Townshend taxes, including the one on tea, the stationing of troops and the Boston Massacre, the closing of the port of Boston and the dissolution of the Massachusetts legislature, escalated colonial rebellion to the point of revolution. The colonists had responded with the Stamp Act Congress, the Sons of Liberty, the Committees of Correspondence, the Boston Tea Party, and finally, in 1774, the setting up of the Continental Congress, an illegal body, forerunner of a future independent government. It was after the military clash at Lexington and Concord in April 1775, between colonial minutemen and British troops, that the Continental Congress decided on separation. They organized a small committee to draw up the Declaration of Independence, which Thomas Jefferson wrote. It was adopted by the Congress on July 2nd and officially proclaimed July 4, 1776. By this time, there was already a powerful sentiment for independence. Resolutions adopted in North Carolina in May of 1776 and sent to the Continental Congress declared independence of England, asserted that all British law was null and void, and urged military preparations. About the same time, the town of Malden, Massachusetts, responding to a request from the Massachusetts House of Representatives that all towns in the state declare their views on independence, had met in town meeting and unanimously called for independence. "We therefore renounce with disdain our connection with a kingdom of slaves. We bid a final adieu to Britain." When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands, they should declare the causes. This was the opening of the Declaration of Independence. Then, in its second paragraph, came the powerful philosophical statement. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government." It then went on to list grievances against the king. "A history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states." Just accused the king of dissolving colonial governments, controlling judges, sending swarms of officers to harass our people, sending in armies of occupation, cutting off colonial trade with other parts of the world, taxing the colonists without their consent, and waging war against them. "Transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny." All this, the language of popular control over governments, the right of rebellion and revolution, indignation at political tyranny, economic burdens, and military attacks, was language well suited to unite large number of colonists and persuade even those who had grievances against one another to turn against England. Some Americans were clearly omitted from this circle of united interests drawn by the Declaration of Independence. Indians, black slaves, women. Indeed, one paragraph of the Declaration charged the king with inciting slave rebellions and Indian attacks. "He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." 20 years before the Declaration, a proclamation of the legislature of Massachusetts of November 3, 1755, declared the Penobscot Indians rebels, enemies, and traitors, and provided a bounty. For every scalp of a male Indian brought in, 40 pounds. For every scalp of such female Indian or male Indian under the age of 12 years that shall be killed, 20 pounds. Thomas Jefferson had written a paragraph of the Declaration accusing the king of transporting slaves from Africa to the colonies and suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or to restrain this execrable commerce. This seemed to express moral indignation against slavery and the slave trade. Jefferson's personal distaste for slavery must be put alongside the fact that he owned hundreds of slaves to the day he died. Behind it was the growing fear among Virginians and some other Southerners about the growing number of black slaves in the colonies, 20% of the total population, and the threat of slave revolts as the number of slaves increased. Jefferson's paragraph was removed by the Continental Congress because slaveholders themselves disagreed about the desirability of ending the slave trade. So even that gesture toward the black slave was omitted in the great Manifesto of Freedom of the American Revolution. The use of the phrase, "all men are created equal," was probably not a deliberate attempt to make a statement about women. It was just that women were beyond consideration as worthy of inclusion. They were politically invisible. Though practical needs gave women a certain authority in the home, on the farm, or in occupations like midwifery, they were simply overlooked in any consideration of political rights, any notions of civic equality. To say that the Declaration of Independence, even by its own language, was limited to life, liberty, and happiness for white males is not to denounce the makers and signers of the Declaration for holding the ideas expected of privileged males of the 18th century. Reformers and radicals, looking discontentedly at history, are often accused of expecting too much from a past political epoch, and sometimes they do. But the point of noting those outside the arc of human rights in the Declaration is not, centuries late and pointlessly, to lay impossible moral burdens on that time. It is to try to understand the way in which the Declaration functioned to mobilize certain groups of Americans, ignoring others. Surely inspirational language to create a secure consensus is still used in our time to cover up serious conflicts of interest in that consensus, and to cover up also the omission of large parts of the human race. The philosophy of the Declaration, that government is set up by the people to secure their life, liberty, and happiness, is to be overthrown when it no longer does that, is often traced to the ideas of John Locke in his Second Treatise on Government. That was published in England in 1689, when the English were rebelling against tyrannical kings and setting up parliamentary government. The Declaration, like Locke's Second Treatise, talked about government and political rights, but ignored the existing inequalities in property. And how could people truly have equal rights with stark differences in wealth? Locke himself was a wealthy man, with investments in the silk trade and slave trade, income from loans and mortgages. He invested heavily in the first issue of the stock of the Bank of England, just a few years after he had written his second treatise, as the classic statement of liberal democracy. As advisor to the Carolinas, he had suggested a government of slave owners run by wealthy land barons. Locke's statement of people's government was in support of a revolution in England for the free development of mercantile capitalism at home and abroad. Locke himself regretted that the labor of poor children is generally lost to the public till they are 12 or 14 years old, and suggested that all children over 3 of families on relief should attend working schools, so they would be from infancy inured to work. The English revolutions of the 17th century brought representative government and opened up discussions of democracy. But as the English historian Christopher Hill wrote in The Puritan Revolution, The establishment of parliamentary supremacy, of the rule of law, no doubt mainly benefited the men of property. The kind of arbitrary taxation that threatened the security of property was overthrown. Monopolies were ended to give more free rein to business, and sea power began to be used for an imperial policy abroad, including the conquest of Ireland. The levelers and the diggers, two political movements which wanted to carry equality into the economic sphere, were put down by the revolution. One can see the reality of Locke's nice phrases about representative government in the class divisions and conflicts in England that followed the revolution that Locke supported. At the very time the American scene was becoming tense, in 1768, England was racked by riots and strikes of coal heavers, sawmill workers, hatters, weavers, sailors, because of the high price of bread and the miserable wages. The Annual Register reviewed the events of the spring and summer of 1768. General dissatisfaction unhappily prevailed among several of the lower orders of the people. This ill temper, which was partly occasioned by the high price of provisions and partly proceeded from other causes, too frequently manifested itself in acts of tumult and riot, which were productive of the most melancholy consequences. The people, who were supposedly at the heart of Locke's theory of people's sovereignty, were defined by a British member of Parliament. "I don't mean the mob. I mean the middling people of England, the manufacturer, the yeoman, the merchant, the country gentleman." In America, too, the reality behind the words of the Declaration of Independence, issued in the same year as Adam Smith's capitalist manifesto, The Wealth of Nations, was that a rising class of important people needed to enlist on their side enough Americans to defeat England without disturbing too much the relations of wealth and power that had developed over 150 years of colonial history. Indeed, 69% of the signers of the Declaration of Independence had held colonial office under England. When the Declaration of Independence was read, with all its flaming radical language, from the town hall balcony in Boston, it was read by Thomas Crafts, a member of the Loyal Nine Group, conservatives who had opposed militant action against the British. 4 days after the reading, the Boston Committee of Correspondence ordered the townsmen to show up on the common for a military draft. The rich, it turned out, could avoid the draft by paying for substitutes. The poor had to serve. This led to rioting and shouting, "Tyranny is tyranny, let it come from whom it may." Chapter 5. A Kind of Revolution. The American victory over the British Army was made possible by the existence of an already armed people. Just about every white male had a gun and could shoot. The revolutionary leadership distrusted the mobs of poor, but they knew the revolution had no appeal to slaves and Indians. They would have to woo the armed white population. This was not easy. Yes, mechanics and sailors, some others, were incensed against the British. But general enthusiasm for the war was not strong. While much of the white population went into military service at one time or another during the war, only a small fraction stayed. John Shy, in his study of the Revolutionary Army, a people numerous and armed, says, "They grew weary of being bullied by local committees of safety, by corrupt deputy assistant commissaries of supply, and by bands of ragged strangers with guns in their hands, calling themselves soldiers of the revolution." Shy estimates that perhaps a fifth of the population was actively treasonous. John Adams had estimated a third opposed, a third in support, a third neutral. Alexander Hamilton, an aide of George Washington and an up-and-coming member of the new elite, wrote from his headquarters, "Our countrymen have all the folly of the ass and all the passiveness of the sheep. They are determined not to be free. If we are saved, France and Spain must save us." Slavery got in the way in the South. South Carolina, insecure since the slave uprising in Stono in 1739, could hardly fight against the British. Her militia had to be used to keep slaves under control. The men who first joined the colonial militia were generally hallmarks of respectability, or at least of full citizenship in their communities, Shai says. Excluded from the militia were friendly Indians, free Negroes, white servants, and free white men who had no stable home. But desperation led to the recruiting of the less respectable whites. Massachusetts and Virginia provided for drafting strollers, vagrants, into the militia. In fact, the military became a place of promise for the poor, who might rise in rank, acquire some money, change their social status. Here was the traditional device by which those in charge of any social order mobilize and discipline a recalcitrant population, offering the adventure and rewards of military service to get poor people to fight for a cause they may not see clearly as their own. A wounded American lieutenant at Bunker Hill, interviewed by Peter Oliver, a Tory, who admittedly might have been looking for such a response, told how he had joined the rebel forces. "I was a shoemaker and got my living by my labor. When this rebellion came on, I saw some of my neighbors got into commission who were no better than myself. I was very ambitious and did not like to see those men above me. I was asked to enlist as a private soldier. I offered to enlist upon having a lieutenant's commission, which was granted. I imagined myself now in a way of promotion. If I was killed in battle, there would be an end of me. But if my captain was killed, I should rise in rank, and should still have a chance to rise higher. These, sir, were the only motives of my entering into the service, for as to the dispute between Great Britain and the colonies, I know nothing of it." John Shai investigated the subsequent experience of that Bunker Hill lieutenant. He was William Scott of Peterborough, New Hampshire, and after a year as prisoner of the British, he escaped, made his way back to the American army, fought in battles in New York, was captured again by the British, and escaped again by swimming the Hudson River, one night with his sword tied around his neck and his watch pinned to his hat. He returned to New Hampshire, recruited a company of his own, including his two eldest sons, and fought in various battles until his health gave way. He watched his eldest son die of camp fever after 6 years of service. He had sold his farm in Peterborough for a note that, with inflation, became worthless. After the war, he came to public attention when he rescued 8 people from drowning after their boat turned over in New York Harbor. He then got a job surveying western lands with the army, but caught a fever and died in 1796. Scott was one of many revolutionary fighters, usually of lower military ranks, from poor and obscure backgrounds. Shai's study of the Peterborough contingent shows that the prominent and substantial citizens of the town had served only briefly in the war. Other American towns show the same pattern. As Shai puts it, "Revolutionary America may have been a middle-class society, happier and more prosperous than any other in its time, but it contained a large and growing number of fairly poor people, and many of them did much of the actual fighting and suffering between 1775 and 1783, a very old story." The military conflict itself, by dominating everything in its time, diminished other issues, made people choose sides in the one contest that was publicly important, forced people onto the side of the revolution, whose interest in independence was not at all obvious. Ruling elites seem to have learned through the generations, consciously or not, that war makes them more secure against internal trouble. The force of military preparation had a way of pushing neutral people into line. In Connecticut, for instance, a law was passed requiring military service of all males between 16 and 60, omitting certain government officials, ministers, Yale students and faculty, Negroes, Indians, and mulattoes. Someone called to duty could provide a substitute or get out of it by paying £5. When 18 men failed to show up for military duty, they were jailed, and in order to be released, had to pledge to fight in the war. Shai says, the mechanism of their political conversion was the militia. What looks like the democratization of the military forces in modern times show up as something different. A way of forcing large numbers of reluctant people to associate themselves with the national cause, and by the end of the process, believe in it. Here, in the war for liberty, was conscription, as usual, cognizant of wealth. With the impressment riots against the British still remembered, impressment of seamen by the American Navy was taking place by 1779. A Pennsylvania official said, we cannot help observing how similar this conduct is to that of the British officers during our subjection to Great Britain, and are persuaded it will have the same unhappy effects, viz. An estrangement of the affections of the people from authority, which by an easy progression will proceed to open opposition and bloodshed. Watching the new tight discipline of Washington's army, a chaplain in Concord, Massachusetts wrote, new lords, new laws. The strictest government is taking place, and great distinction is made between officers and men. Everyone is made to know his place and keep it, or be immediately tied up and receive not one, but 30 or 40 lashes. The Americans lost the first battles of the war, Bunker Hill, Brooklyn Heights, Harlem Heights, the Deep South. They won small battles at Trenton and Princeton, and then, in a turning point, a big battle at Saratoga, New York in 1777. Washington's frozen army hung on at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, while Benjamin Franklin negotiated an alliance with the French monarchy, which was anxious for revenge on England. The war turned to the south, where the British won victory after victory, until the Americans, aided by a large French army, with the French Navy blocking off the British from supplies and reinforcements, won the final victory of the war at Yorktown, Virginia in 1781. Through all this, the suppressed conflicts between rich and poor among the Americans kept reappearing. In the midst of the war, in Philadelphia, which Eric Foner describes as a time of immense profits for some colonists and terrible hardships for others, the inflation, prices rose in 1 month that year by 45%, led to agitation and calls for action. One Philadelphia newspaper carried a reminder that in Europe, the people have always done themselves justice when the scarcity of bread has arisen from the avarice of forestallers. They have broken open magazines, appropriated stores to their own use without paying for them, and in some instances have hung up the culprits who created their distress. In May of 1779, the 1st Company of Philadelphia Artillery petitioned the Assembly about the troubles of the middling and poor, and threatened violence against those who are avariciously intent upon amassing wealth by the destruction of the more virtuous part of the community. That same month, there was a mass meeting, an extra-legal gathering, which called for price reductions and initiated an investigation of Robert Morris, a rich Philadelphian who was accused of holding food from the market. In October came the Fort Wilson riot, in which a militia group marched into the city and to the house of James Wilson, a wealthy lawyer and revolutionary official who had opposed price controls and the democratic constitution adopted in Pennsylvania in 1776. The militia were driven away by a silk stocking brigade of well-off Philadelphia citizens. It seemed that the majority of white colonists, who had a bit of land or no property at all, were still better off than slaves or indentured servants or Indians, and could be wooed into the coalition of the revolution. But when the sacrifices of war became more bitter, the privileges and safety of the rich became harder to accept. About 10% of the white population, an estimate of Jackson Maine in The Social Structure of Revolutionary America, large landholders and merchants held 1,000 pounds or more in personal property, and 1,000 pounds in land at the least, and these men owned nearly half the wealth of the country and held as slaves 1/7 of the country's people. The Continental Congress, which governed the colonies through the war, was dominated by rich men, linked together in factions and compacts by business and family connections. These links connected North and South, East and West. For instance, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia was connected with the Adamses of Massachusetts and the Shippens of Pennsylvania. Delegates from Middle and Southern colonies were connected with Robert Morris of Pennsylvania through commerce and land speculation. Morris was superintendent of finance, and his assistant was Governor Morris. Morris's plan was to give more assurance to those who had loaned money to the Continental Congress and gain the support of officers by voting half pay for life for those who stuck to the end. This ignored the common soldier who was not getting paid, who was suffering in the cold, dying of sickness, watching the civilian profiteers get rich. On New Year's Day, 1781, the Pennsylvania troops near Morristown, New Jersey, perhaps emboldened by rum, dispersed their officers, killed one captain, wounded others, and were marching fully armed with cannon toward the Continental Congress at Philadelphia. George Washington handled it cautiously. Informed of these developments by General Anthony Wayne, he told Wayne not to use force. He was worried that the rebellion might spread to his own troops. He suggested Wayne get a list of the soldiers' grievances and said Congress should not flee Philadelphia because then the way would be open for the soldiers to be joined by Philadelphia citizens. He sent Knox rushing to New England on his horse to get 3 months' pay for the soldiers while he prepared 1,000 men to march on the mutineers as a last resort. A peace was negotiated in which one half the men were discharged, the other half got furloughs. Shortly after this, a smaller mutiny took place in the New Jersey line involving 200 men who defied their officers and started out for the same state capital at Trenton. Now Washington was ready. 600 men, who themselves had been well fed and clothed, marched on the mutineers and surrounded and disarmed them. Three ringleaders were put on trial immediately in the field. One was pardoned, and two were shot by firing squads made up of their friends, who wept as they pulled the triggers. It was an example, Washington said. 2 years later, there was another mutiny in the Pennsylvania line. The war was over and the army had disbanded, but 80 soldiers, demanding their pay, invaded the Continental Congress headquarters in Philadelphia and forced the members to flee across the river to Princeton, ignominiously turned out of the doors, as one historian sorrowfully wrote, John Fiske, The Critical Period, by a handful of drunken mutineers. What soldiers in the Revolution could do only rarely, rebel against their authorities, civilians could do much more easily. Ronald Hoffman says, "The Revolution plunged the states of Delaware, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and to a much lesser degree Virginia, into divisive civil conflicts that persisted during the entire period of struggle. The Southern lower classes resisted being mobilized for the Revolution. They saw themselves under the rule of a political elite, win or lose against the British." In Maryland, for instance, by the new Constitution of 1776, to run for governor, one had to own 5,000 pounds of property, to run for state senator, 1,000 pounds. Thus, 90% of the population were excluded from holding office. And so, as Hoffman says, small slaveholders, non-slaveholding planters, tenants, renters, and casual day laborers posed a serious problem of social control for the Whig elite. With black slaves, 25% of the population, and in some counties, 50%, fear of slave revolts grew. George Washington had turned down the requests of blacks seeking freedom to fight in the Revolutionary Army. So when the British military commander in Virginia, Lord Dunmore, promised freedom to Virginia slaves who joined his forces, this created consternation. A report from one Maryland county worried about poor whites encouraging slave runaways. "The insolence of the Negroes in this county is come to such a height that we are under a necessity of disarming them which we effected on Saturday last. We took about 80 guns, some bayonets, swords, etc. The malicious and imprudent speeches of some among the lower classes of whites have induced them to believe that their freedom depended on the success of the king's troops. We cannot therefore be too vigilant nor too rigorous with those who promote and encourage this disposition in our slaves. Even more unsettling was white rioting in Maryland against leading families supporting the revolution who were suspected of hoarding needed commodities. The class hatred of some of these disloyal people was expressed by one man who said, "It was better for the people to lay down their arms and pay the duties and taxes laid upon them by king and parliament than to be brought into slavery and to be commanded and ordered about as they were." A wealthy Maryland landowner, Charles Carroll, took note of the surly mood all around him. "There is a mean, low, dirty envy which creeps through all ranks and cannot suffer a man a superiority of fortune, of merit, or of understanding in fellow citizens. Either of those are sure to entail a general ill will and dislike upon the owners." Despite this, Maryland authorities retained control. They made concessions, taxing land and slaves more heavily, letting debtors pay in paper money. It was a sacrifice by the upper class to maintain power, and it worked. In the lower South, however, in the Carolinas and Georgia, according to Hoffman, vast regions were left without the slightest apparition of authority. The general mood was to take no part in a war that seemed to have nothing for them. Authoritative personages on both sides demanded that common people supply material, reduce consumption, leave their families, and even risk their lives. Forced to make hard decisions, many flailed out in frustration or evaded and defied first one side, then the other. Washington's military commander in the lower South, Nathaniel Greene, dealt with disloyalty by a policy of concessions to some, brutality to others. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, he described a raid by his troops on loyalists. "They made a dreadful carnage of them. Upwards of 100 were killed, and most of the rest cut to pieces. It has had a very happy effect on those disaffected persons, of which there were too many in this country." Greene told one of his generals, "To strike terror into our enemies and give spirit to our friends." On the other hand, he advised the governor of Georgia, "To open a door for the disaffected of your state to come in." In general, throughout the states, concessions were kept to a minimum. The new constitutions that were drawn up in all states from 1776 to 1780 were not much different from the old ones, although property qualifications for voting and holding office were lowered in some instances. In Massachusetts, they were increased. Only Pennsylvania abolished them totally. The new bills of rights had modifying provisions. North Carolina, providing for religious freedom, added that "nothing herein contained shall be construed to exempt preachers of treasonable or seditious discourses from legal trial and punishment." Maryland, New York, Georgia, and Massachusetts took similar cautions. The American Revolution is sometimes said to have brought about the separation of church and state. The northern states made such declarations, but after 1776, they adopted taxes that forced everyone to support Christian teachings. William G. McLaughlin, quoting Supreme Court Justice David Brewer in 1892, that "this is a Christian nation," says of the separation of church and state in the Revolution that it was "neither conceived of nor carried out, far from being left to itself. Religion was embedded into every aspect and institution of American life." One would look, in examining the Revolution's effect on class relations, at what happened to land confiscated from fleeing loyalists. It was distributed in such a way as to give a double opportunity to the revolutionary leaders to enrich themselves and their friends, and to parcel out some land to small farmers to create a broad base of support for the new government. Indeed, this became characteristic of the new nation. Finding itself possessed of enormous wealth, it could create the richest ruling class in history and still have enough for the middle classes to act as a buffer between the rich and the dispossessed. The huge landholdings of the Loyalists had been one of the great incentives to revolution. Lord Fairfax in Virginia had more than 5 million acres encompassing 21 counties. Lord Baltimore's income from his Maryland holdings exceeded £30,000 a year. After the Revolution, Lord Fairfax was protected. He was a friend of George Washington. But other Loyalist holders of